This is Dave Crippen at the in Grosse Pointe Woods. We are continuing our series of interviews with seminal designers, automotive and industrial designers, those who have influenced the course of the industry. And today we're talking with Gordon Burig, who is well known to all as a great influence on the course of automotive design. And we're going to ask Mr. Burig to start to tell of his career and his experiences in his own way, starting with his earliest influences.
Am I close enough to the microphone? Does it work then? Well, my career started 60 years ago in Wayne, Michigan, at the Godfredson Body Plant, which was building bodies at that time for Will St. Clair, Peerless, and Jewett. And at that time, all automobile bodies were wood frame with either steel or aluminum paneling. And the automobile industry, the body business, which of course is the only part I know about is the body end of it. The tooling was a very inexpensive process, very straightforward, and it was a process inherited from the carriage business. And we are indebted to the foreigners from Europe mainly, from Germany and England and Russia and so on, where they were building, where the carriage industry had flourished. And then the carriage industry got pretty well going in America. And Cincinnati was at one time sort of the carriage industry headquarters of America. But when the automobile started, the automobile pioneers were primarily engineers, chassis men, and so they turned to the custom body or to the carriage builders to come up with bodies for them. And so the process at Godfredson, which I'll describe very briefly.
How do you spell that, Mr.
Godfredson? Godfredson. There's still Godfredsons living in Grosse Pointe.
Really?
Yeah, they were in the truck business, and then they opened up this body shop in Wayne, Michigan, and I went in as an apprentice. I was 20 years old at the time, and I won't go into the details of body drafting, but body surface development is an old art which is somewhat similar to the lofting of boat hulls or aircraft work, but it was a direct descendant from the carriage business. And so they would design, or the designer would come up with certain empirical lines, and from that the surfaces would be developed. Well, from the body surface, after that had been described, then the body engineer would lay in the woodwork, and the body drafts included every joint and every screw, and everything was all shown there. And so these pieces of wood had to be milled, so that they would fit exactly under the skin. And that was what we would do in the body shop, in the sample body shop. We would actually build a sample body framework directly off the body draft. And when that was finished, it would be put together just the way a finished body would be put together, except that we would not use any glue. We'd put the screws in and screw the whole thing together, and then that was a final checkout for the body framework. After that was done, the body framework parts were all given names and part numbers, and the body then was disassembled, and each part was marked with its part number, and was shellacked and put in the tool room, and that was our tooling. So they would build at Godfredson maybe a run of 300 or 400 bodies at a time. The problem would be one of space, of putting the parts, because they would set up a machine to mill a certain one of the body components, and they would run off, say, 400 parts, and those would be stacked on dollies and set aside, and then that same machine would be set up to run another part. So you had to run all the parts on the body, say for a run of 400 units, and then as soon as a part was set up, then the master part was put back in the tool room. And so when you got enough 400 parts of every part of the body, then they would move those over and put them into the assembly jig and frame up that many bodies. Well, obviously this was pretty inexpensive, and I think that maybe $30,000 or $40,000 was enough money to tool up the framework. And body panels were reasonably simple in those days, and the body was usually designed with belt moldings to cover the joints between the panels, and these moldings were, here was where a designer had a little bit of leeway. He could put the molding where he thought it looked the best, and the exterior panels would be so designed. And then they would be drilled and nailed right onto the wood framework. And then the molding, which was usually about an eighth of an inch thick, aluminum, and that would be drilled with a special kind of a bit that brought up a burr around the hole. And so then that would be nailed on, and that would cover the joints between the sheet metal panels. And the nail would be driven in pretty well, and then you would hammer the burr down over the top of it, and then file it off, and that gave you the smooth finish, which would hide where the nail was. That was the process. And so in those days, we had a lot of automobile companies. I think there were, my memory serves me right, 95 automobile companies that showed in the auto show in 1924. The reason that there were so many of them was that it required very little money to get into the automobile business. There were a number of companies building engines, Lycoming in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and there was Continental Engines in Detroit, and I think there were one or two other engine companies, and then there was Warner Gear that made transmissions for a lot of different cars. Columbia Axle built axles, and the I can't think of the name of the company up in Milwaukee that made the frames for most all of the cars. They're still in business. And so if an entrepreneur had a few thousand dollars and an engineer and an idea for a new car, he could pick components off the shelf, so to speak, from the industry and put together a fairly reasonable automobile. And these were called assembled cars, and there were many, many of them. One that comes to mind was the Jordan car in Cleveland, which had a Continental engine. But then there were some body companies. We had the Briggs Body Company in Detroit, and we had the C.R. Wilson Body Company and the Murray Body Company, and as I mentioned, Godfredson Body Company. So someone with an entrepreneur with a new automobile idea could have a small factory and ship in all these components, including the bodies, and he was in the automobile business. Then around in the early 30s, the trend was toward the all-steel bodies, which was a step forward in one respect, in that it, if you could afford the tooling cost, you could produce a body at less cost. The problem was, in the early all-steel bodies, that they were very tinny sounding. And so the first ones were for trucks, where it didn't matter how much noise was in the car. And I think at that time Ford was building their open cars, which rattled, of course, in all steel bodies, and their commercial cars, and but their closed cars were all still wood framework with the steel panels, because you had the sound of quality when you would slam the door. And at that time, Henry Ford had extensive holdings in the Upper Peninsula around Iron Mountain of thousands of acres of timber, because he wanted to be sure that he never ran out of wood for the wood frames of bodies. Fisher Body had a similar commitment of forestry. I believe it was in North Carolina or somewhere where they had. See, the wood that we used primarily was hard maple. The custom bodies were made usually of ash, which was a stronger material than maple, but really not as nice to work with as the maple for production cars. And at that time, Henry Ford, who was very cost conscious, designed the crates for components that he would buy on the outside. If he were buying axles or something of that sort, he would design the crates and specify the material that those crates would be made out of. When they came in, the crates were taken apart and used for floorboards. And so anyway, they, in any point in the history of the automobile industry, you work with what knowledge is available at the time. And the knowledge that was not available in the early days of all steel bodies was the manner of silencing the steel panels. And so with working with the chemical companies, they finally came up with materials that would be sprayed on the inner panels of the steel bodies. And through this method, we finally got all steel bodies that sounded like quality cars, and virtually all automobiles now are built that way. But the catch is that to build a body of that type in today's market, we're talking, instead of $40,000 or $50,000 to tool a body, we're talking about $200 million. And so the advent of the all-steel body combined with the Great Depression that started in 1929 wiped out most of the smaller automobile companies. And when the investment got larger, then the gamble was so much greater that the companies could afford to spend a lot more money in the design and development of a prototype body, because it was very important that they be right when they got their car on the market. And this was when they started building full-size clay models to check out design. Prior to that, they were built to the geometric layout of the body draft. And the first time you saw it in full size was on a prototype body. We shut it off for a minute. My first 4 years in the automobile industry was in apprenticeship and in engineering, and I had gone from Godfredson Body over to the Diedrich Body Company in Detroit. Ray Diedrich had a fine custom body shop here, and from there to Packard. And I was working at Packard in body engineering. This would go around about 1927 and perhaps early 28. Harley Earl had been brought to Detroit from California to do some design work for Cadillac, and over there he, with the help of Ralph Pugh,
P-U-G-H.
What?
P-U-G-H.
I believe it is, yeah, Ralph Pugh, did the original LaSalle car, which was a styling very exciting car when it came out. And as a result of that, Harley Earl was moved over to the General Motors building. He had a little office on the 10th floor, and he started a design department for all of General Motors, and he called it Art and Color. And I was playing tennis one day with a friend of mine who was a draftsman working for Harley, and he suggested I talk to him, and I went over, and by taking a reduction in salary, I went from Packard to get my first experience in the design department. And at that time, we were building models in full-size clay. We were importing the clay from Germany, and the clay that is used in the automobile industry is entirely different from clay used by sculptors. It's a material that is sensitive to heat, and at normal room temperatures is very hard, and at about 105 degrees is quite soft and pliable. And at that time, we would take these blocks of clay and put them in buckets of boiling water and heat them up, and then pull out this hot clay and push it onto the armature. This didn't last very long until they built some electric ovens, and the whole process became very sophisticated. And General Motors, through some connection, I don't know how they worked it out, but they found a company in New Jersey by the name of Chavant Manufacturing Company. C-H-E-V-A-N-T, I think it is, Chavant. And they were able to duplicate the clay from Germany. And that company is still in business and supplies all the clay for the industry, and has ever since. And so John Lutz was an old German fella who, in fact, most of the people, the tradespeople in Fisher Body and at General Motors at that time were Germans. And they used to say they spoke German in Fisher Body as much as they spoke English. Anyway, John Lutz was a clay modeler and was head of it, and I was anxious to learn how to do it, so he let me fool around with the shaping one of the fenders, and I was pretty proud of it. And then he said I could do better with an axe, and he probably could. Anyway, we were designing the pregnant Buick at that time, and the only part of it that actually was where I had an influence was that I did design the instrument panel for the 29 Buick. And from there, I went with Stutz in Indianapolis, mainly to make more money and to be the head of the design department at Stutz. But Stutz was sort of on its way out. They had a man by the name of Colonel Gorell, who was president of the company, and a man by the name of Moskowitz, who was chairman of the board. And when I got there, Stutz had just come out with a new model, which was designed, bodies were designed and built by LeBaron in Detroit, which was a division of the Briggs Company. And it was an ordinary bit of design work. It was not bad, but their Roadster and their touring car, or Phaeton, were not very well designed. They had a scoop-down door that was rather poorly worked out. So about all I got done at Stutz was to redesign that door, and the cowling, and another thing was that the windshield on that car was a folding type windshield, which was quite popular in those days, and was held in the up or down position by a friction nut on the hand operator, the hand knurled knob on the end, which would hold the windshield in the up position or the down position. Well, while I was still at General Motors, I bought a 29 Buick, and the Buick Roadster, and it had the same arrangement. And the car was not fast, the day standard, but it would do 70 miles an hour. And at 70 miles an hour, with the windshield down, it would suddenly flop up in your face. So at Stutz, I redesigned the windshield by having two centers, one for the axis of the windshield, and then a tapered pin that would fasten in with two notches. One notch would hold it in the down position and one notch in the up position. So by and this didn't take an awful lot of strength either, because once it was in there, it was locked in because of these notches. So the new Stutz windshield did not flop up at high speed.
Was the Stutz Roadster the famous Bearcat?
No, the Bearcat was there actually earlier than that. The only other thing I did at Stutz was that in the Le Mans race in France, a man by the name of Brissard, I believe it was, had come in second or third with a Stutz car, and he wanted three new cars built for the next year's race. And this was a very exciting assignment. They took a small Stutz Blackhawk chassis and put the large Stutz engine in it, and then they put a positive displacement supercharger out in front of the radiator. It's similar to the arrangement on that most people are familiar with the English Bentleys. And my assignment on it was to design the body. And that particular year in the Le Mans race, the car had to be built with fenders and, of course, headlights, because it's a 24-hour race. And it had to have a four-passenger body. And the body specifications were quite complete for the front seat, not so much for the rear seat. So I did quite a bit of cheating in the rear, and the body was to be built by the Wayman Body Company in Indianapolis, which was a branch of the Wayman Body Company of England, where they built bodies that were covered with chicken wire and then padding and then with a fabric covering, which made a very fine body and a very lightweight body. So the problem was to design the wood framework and the body, because you were very limited on compound curvature when you were working with stretched fabrics. But anyway, the cars were built and sent to France, and that was a rather exciting thing for me to do. But about that time, I heard there was that Duesenberg was looking for a designer, and so around the time of the Indianapolis race in 1929, I moved over to Duesenberg as their body designer, Let's stop a minute. The situation at Duesenberg when I moved over there was the Model J Duesenberg was already in production. In fact, between between my jobs at General Motors and Stutz, I had made a trip to New York as a sort of a vacation, and attended the fine car show at the salon at the Commodore Hotel, and this was the introduction of the Model J Duesenberg, and they had a LeBaron Phaeton and a Murphy convertible roadster, and I presume some other models, but those were the two that struck my eye. And of course, they were the hit of the auto show.
What year was this?
This was in, this would have been in 28. And so, of course, I was so enthused about that automobile, and then about 6 months later, here I was as the body designer for them. But the Duesenberg Company, which was at that time part of the Cord Corporation, and Fred Duesenberg had been employed as vice president and chief engineer. His brother Augie Duesenberg was not connected with the company, and Augie was had a little race car shop across the street from the Duesenberg plant, and continued his activity in auto racing. But anyway, the Duesenberg Company did not build bodies. This is was not unusual. This would be like Pierce Arrow or any of the most any of the fine foreign companies. They just built chassis. And the custom body firms built the bodies. And at that time, there were some very fine custom body firms in the United States. There was the Willoughby Company, the Judkins Company at Merrimack, Massachusetts, and there was the Brunn Company in, I believe, in Buffalo, and then there was the Durham Body in Rosemont, Pennsylvania. The Murphy Body Company in Pasadena, California, C.R. Kimball Body Company in Chicago, and Locke, I forget, Locke, I believe, was in Rochester. And there were, Waterhouse was another one, too, a very fine custom body firm. So, in organizing the introduction of the car, Harold Ames, who was the vice president in charge of sales, at that time, E.L. Cord was president of the company, but I never saw him at that time. Anyway, Ames did what would be the normal thing to do, is to go to the custom body firms and have them design a line of bodies for his new chassis. And this, of course, was before the stock market crash. And I think that Ames was conservative in his purchase of bodies, and that he would only buy maybe 10 of a kind, whereas the custom body business for Lincoln or Packard, they would usually buy 100. But Ames bought, let's say, 10 bodies of a type. And in the case of the Murphy body Roadster, that was a very popular model, and they built many of those, and the LeBaron Phaeton also. But The other bodies, we had a little too many of them. And also we had two wheelbases. One was 142 and a half and the other 153 and a half. And in ordering frames from the A.O. Smith Company, that's a company I couldn't think of the other, a little while ago, we got more of the short wheelbase, 142 inch wheelbase, 142 and a half. And so the five passenger bodies were supposed to be fitted onto the 142 and a half inch wheelbase, and the longer wheelbase for seven passenger town cars, things of that sort. Well, the problem that we had in selling the Duesenberg was that it was, of course, a very high priced car, $8,500 for the chassis alone, and our bodies, the average Duesenberg at that time was selling from $12,000 to $14,000 complete. The problem was this, that a custom body company in those days had certain inherent characteristics. If you were knowledgeable about car bodies, you could usually look seeing a car in the auto show, you could tell whether the body was built by LeBaron or built by Willoughby or built by Judkins. They all had their individual hardware that they used for everything. And they also had sweeps, a certain roof sweep or a certain body turn under. The body cross section would be. And the body engineer, regardless of where somebody had put the design moldings or things of that sort, he still would get that body roof panel sweep down, and that was the roof line. And he'd get a turn under body side sweep, and that was the side sweep. So, and of course, a body built by one body company for Lincoln would be of exactly the same quality as they would build that body for Duesenberg. And because of this built-in similarity that that a company had in making their bodies, a body on a Duesenberg built by Brunn, we'll say, and designed by Brunn, was very, very similar to one done by Brunn for Lincoln. And so in the auto shows, customers would look at the Duesenberg and see a Brunn-bodied town car at $15,000, see the same body on a Lincoln for probably $6,000. And the Lincoln car was, as far as manufacturing precision concerned, equal to the Duesenberg. And they'd go over and look at a Pierce Arrow and see the Brunn town car on a Pierce Arrow, same body. And that one might be priced at $8,000. But here's Duesenberg at $15,000. And a lot of owners in the luxury car market had chauffeurs, and they were primarily interested in comfort and in design detail and so forth. But the one thing that the Duesenberg had that the others didn't have was a top speed of probably 20 miles an hour more than the rest of them. And so this appealed to the sporting individual who liked to drive his own car and might buy a LeBaron Phaeton and plan to drive it himself because of the thrill of driving at 100 miles an hour or better. But to the person buying a town car, that didn't mean anything. The chauffeur was going to be driving it, and they wanted quiet comfort. So this caused a big problem in the sale of Duesenberg cars. And so that was the reason that I think Ames was interested in having individual designs. Now, if I had been the illustrator type of designer and would merely make sketches, outside sketches of the design of a car, and we would have sent it to a custom body company, we would not have solved the problem, because the body engineer would still use the same sweeps and the contours would be the same, and it would still look like a body from Durham or LeBaron or what have you. However, having had 4 years of training in engineering, I was able to make body drafts. And I'd make these in a small scale, and the body draft, I'd make a design and show it to Ames and get his approval, and then I would lay it out as a body draft. And on the body draft, I showed the empirical lines in the side elevation, the plan view, and the end views, and the cross sections, and so forth. I never attempted to show construction, because these body companies knew how to build things. But we wanted the exterior surface to be individual. So the bodies that I designed that were built by different body companies were, when those were shown in the auto show, they were unique. You couldn't get those bodies on a Lincoln or a Pierce Arrow. And so those sold real well. The problem was that Ames had a backlog of these old bodies still in the warehouse. See, the way the custom body business worked was that a company would buy, and in our case, maybe 10 bodies. In the case of Packard, 100 bodies. And those bodies would be stored at the body builder. Then the salesman in Denver or Chicago or wherever would get an order for that car and would get the customer to select colors and interior trim. The bodies were always stored in a prime coat of paint and muslin covered upholstery. And so when the order would come in, they would send a chassis to the body company. The body company then would take a body out of storage and paint it and trim it and deck it on the chassis, and a custom body could be available by that manner in about a month's time. And that was the real backbone of the custom body business. There were occasional one-off bodies, and we had a Duesenberg. We had a few occasions where we built one or maybe two or three cars. So the stock market crash not only put a lot of small companies out of business, but it also hampered the sale of Duesenbergs. Not everyone lost all their money in the stock market, and those that had money wanted to retain their chauffeurs, and yet they didn't want to drive in a car as ostentatious as a Duesenberg, especially with people standing in bread lines. So this very much hampered the sale of Duesenberg cars. In fact, during that period, Ford Motor had their Model A car in production, and were able to sell quite a lot of Model A town cars. And that was just a product of the times, because here a wealthy person could keep his chauffeur on the payroll, and yet driving around town in a Model A town car was certainly not the same as driving around in a Duesen. While I was at Duesenberg, I wasn't making much money, but one of the fringe benefits I had was that I did get to drive the automobiles, and I was single at the time, and we usually had some, quite often would have some occasion for a car to be driven to Chicago for a customer, or maybe a car up there to be picked up and brought back to the factory for service.
Where was Duesenberg based?
Indianapolis, West Washington Street. And so I would ask Ames if had anything going to Chicago. And so I would have an expense account, and I could drive a Duesenberg to Chicago on Friday evening and turn it in on Sunday and take a train back to Indianapolis. In the meantime, I could impress my girlfriends in Chicago, or my friends that I had up there. And but anyway, it was always fun to be able to drive a Duesenberg, and I had no idea that I would ever be able to afford one. But I wanted a custom body car. And when the Model A Ford came out in 1929, well, it was a 1930 model that I bought, I visualized redesigning the body and making it into a custom car. So I traded my Buick Roadster in and bought a Ford Victoria. I think that's what they call it, the two-passenger convertible. And before I got delivery of it, I had made a full-size body draft of it, what I wanted to do, and made arrangements with Augie Duesenberg at his race car shop to build the body for me. And I drove the car from the dealership out to Augie's place, and first thing we did was take the body off the chassis. Then we cut the body back of the body B post, which is the back of the door, and that rumble seat, all that area, we threw that away, and kept the body frame sills. We mounted the body back on the chassis 4.5 inches aft of its normal location. Then we built a dummy cowling, or extended cowling, so that the firewall was moved forward into its normal location in relation to the engine. And this, then I had to build a new engine hood, which was 4.5 inches longer than the regular engine hood. Then the back of the body was all new, framed in wood and made out of aluminum, and it extended just a little bit beyond the rear axle. And then I had a large trunk on the back, and on the inside I had a single seat facing the center, and the passenger seat was built so it would fold forward so that you could get into that rear one passenger enclosed rumble seat. It was a blind quarter convertible. Beautiful thing. I lowered the, cut the windshield down to the top of the upper hinge on the door, and that I think was 3.5 inches. So the body was 3.5 inches lower than the regular four. At that time, the Wayman Body Company was going out of business, and I bought some of their hides of leather for $5 a hide. And when Augie was through with it, we moved it across the street to the Duesenberg plant, where they allowed me to have it painted and trimmed by the head trimmer and the head painter at Duesenberg. We did have a good paint and trim shop. So the quality of the car was equal to Duesenberg. And I drove that car almost 100,000 miles, and I finally sold it in Auburn later on when Mr. Ames told me he thought I should drive a company car. And I've regretted that all my life. I've tried many times to find it. It was written up in the Ford Times magazine. And about 3 or 4 years ago, a friend of mine by the name of Bob Amundsen in California, I made some drawings for him. I had enough information that I could reconstruct a body draft from it. And I originally did this for Bill Hara. Bill wanted to build one. And he bought a car, but he never got around to it. Never got around to scheduling it through his shop. But Bob Amundsen did build one. And it was written up in a magazine not too long ago as the most beautiful Model A ever built so far. But I think it's kind of significant in that, as far as I know, this is the first time a designer took a stock car of that sort and modified it and made it into a different type of automobile. There had been a lot of speedsters built, you know, in the old days off of Model T's and so forth. But the process that I used, I think, was probably the first time that had ever been done. Around the end of 1932, business was pretty bad at Duesenberg, and there would be months go by without selling a car. And so I thought, for my survival, I better get with a stronger company. I got in touch with Howard O'Leary at General Motors to see if I could get back into their art and color section, and was accepted. So I think it was in January of 1933 that I left Duesenberg, and that was the weekend that Franklin Roosevelt closed all the banks, had the bank holiday. So I got to Detroit and started working for General Motors. And I remember we, at one point we had to go downtown, to downtown Detroit, to get our paychecks cashed. And Art and Color was still part of Fisher Body at that time. And so things were actually a little bit dull at General Motors, and in retrospect, I'm surprised that they hired me at that time. But Harley Earl came up with an idea of having a design contest among his designers with some sort of advanced thinking. And We were given a package drawing. I think it was probably about the size of a Buick. And we were divided up into different teams. And they were four-man teams, except for me, and I was given five. The reason was that two of mine were apprentices. And so the I had young John Lutz Jr., which was whose father ran the clay shop, the prototype clay work. And John was a good model builder. And the design was to be presented in a one-quarter scale model in clay. And Jack Morgan was head of one of the teams, and Tom Hibbert had a team, and I think Agramonte had one. Anyway, there was about six different teams. Frank Hershey had one. And I remember the model that Frank Hershey came up with had the stripes running back across the top of the hood, which he later became the head of the studio for Pontiac. And they had that silver streak. That was one thing that that survived the design contest. Anyway, the prize for the contest was to be the whole team would be taken to Chicago to the World's Fair and provided with a limousine and a chauffeur and spending money for a week. And so anyway, Jack Morgan won. Ricardo Morgan Jack won the contest, and his group got to go to Chicago. The judges for the contest were a couple of the Fisher brothers and heads of different GM plants. And the car that we came up with came in last. And at that point in time, I was living at Alden Park Manor on Jefferson Street, and our design team would get together out there, and we'd drink beer and work on this design. And at that time I was driving this Model A Ford, which I was very proud of, and I kept the engine spotless all the time. And it took a lot of time to keep the engine clean. So I came up with the idea of a hermetically sealed engine compartment, which would keep the engine clean, and having the radiators located between the hood and the fenders. And so that was the way our model was designed, and it was a very streamlined, very unusual looking car. And I think the reason that we got last place on it was that it really didn't look like an automobile, it was something different. But anyway, prior to that judging, we had a different contest where the different designers were to look at all the models and to pick their idea of the best looking car of the group. And well, the competition was the real competition was designed was judged by a couple of the Fisher brothers and the heads of Buick and Pontiac and Chevrolet and so forth. And but this other was the designers themselves had they voted, and on that we got first place. Well, it was a pretty wild looking automobile, I'll admit, but anyhow.
Can you describe it a bit?
Yeah, it looked like the Accord. And so not too long after this, I had a call one day from Harold Ames in Indianapolis, and He wanted me to come down for the weekend. And so I drove down there, and he had an idea. Really, it was not too original. But at that point in time, Cadillac came out with a low-priced LaSalle, which was built on a Oldsmobile chassis. Cadillac denied that it was Oldsmobile, but it was pretty well known through the industry that it was a straight Oldsmobile chassis. There was nothing wrong with that, and it had a Fleetwood body on it. And this gave the Cadillac dealers a low-priced car, and this is the middle of the Depression. So Ames got the idea that we could take an Auburn straight eight chassis and come up with what he called a trick body and merchandise it as, you want to turn that on? Anyway, this Auburn was a good chassis, and it was an inexpensive chassis, and Ames thought, well, with a tricky body, we could have a lower priced car carrying the name Duesenberg. And he wanted me to design it. Well, for an automobile designer, this is pretty exciting to have a chance to start from scratch and design a whole new automobile. So I made a sketch of a car, which was pretty much what we had shown at General Motors, that they, where they gave us last place, and I was telling Ames about it, and he liked the idea. So I left General Motors, went back to Duesenberg, and we had one room sealed off in the Duesenberg plant where we were going to build this car. And of course, Fred Duesenberg had died. Fred had been dead for about 2 years at this point. And in the meantime, why, they had hired Augie Duesenberg, Fred's brother.
About 1933,
33. Yeah, 1933, the latter part of 1933. The chassis development of this car was turned over to Augie Duesenberg, and Walter Trummel and some of our layout draftsmen worked out this twin radiator thing, and I made a small clay model of the car and some drafting, a drafting layout of it. And then we had the body built over at Wayman Body, which is still in business, in Indianapolis. And Phil Derham was working for us as a body engineer at that time, and Phil followed the thing over at Wayman. And I think at this time E.L. Cord was living on his yacht in England and pretty much lost interest in the automobile industry. And he also had built himself a home in Beverly Hills, California, and, but his main office was in Chicago. So this car was kept top secret. People at Duesenberg were not even allowed to see it. And so then one day they brought it out of the garage and drove it to Chicago to show it to Mr. Cord. He was not interested enough to come to Indianapolis to see it. And then they locked it up again. And about this time, they had the auto show in New York, and the Auburn company came out with a completely new line of automobiles. In 1934, Auburn was completely new. And Auburn was in rather shaky financial condition, but they had gambled, because this was an all-steel body. They had gambled a lot of money on the production of this 34 Auburn. which was designed by Al Leamy. And really, there was nothing wrong with it. And when you see a 34 Auburn today, you wonder why it didn't sell. But it sort of bombed out at the New York Auto Show. The dealers didn't like it. And Harold Ames, who was my boss, of course, at Duesenberg, was down there, and coming back to Chicago on the train with Lou Manning, who was chairman of the board of the Cord Corporation, Ames told Manning that he knew what was wrong with it. So Manning said, well, if you know what's wrong with it, you're the one to fix it. So they moved Ames from Indianapolis to Auburn as executive vice president. And of course, Ames thought that with the title of executive vice president, he could run the company. However, about the same time, Roy Faulkner, who had been president of Auburn for a number of years and had left to go with Pierce Arrow, was brought back as president of Auburn. So here were two men who disliked each other intensely, had offices across the hall from each other, and it made the Auburn Automobile Company a two-headed monster that was not able to function very well. And it split up the loyalty of the personnel to Roy Faulkner was hometown and everybody knew him and liked him. Ames was an intruder from Indianapolis, and I was an Ames man. And also Al Leamy was still there as the designer, and he was a real fine designer. He had designed the L29 Cord, probably one of the most beautiful cars ever built. But I was brought in to redesign it. So I had a small group, and the only input we got from Harold Ames was that he wanted it to have a big hood on it. He wanted the car to look powerful. So the only difference between the 34 Auburn and the 35 Auburn is basically the hood and radiator grill, which we did in full size in clay in a couple of weeks. Ames liked it, and then it was up to Bart Cotter and Ted Allen and the body engineering to put it out on drawings and to make the die models. And so the 34 Auburn came out in January and the 35 Auburn came out in June. And it was pretty successful. And Augie Duesenberg came to Auburn. He still lived in Indianapolis, but he came up there most of the year 1934, which is 50 years ago. And he adapted the Switzer Cummins supercharger to the 35 Auburn. So, and we had a supercharged Duesenberg for several years, and so we copied the exposed out exhaust pipes that we had on the Duesenberg. Fred Duesenberg's initial reason for putting the outside exhaust pipes on was to get the heat out from under the hood. And Mercedes had the same problem, and they had outside exhaust pipes with a stainless steel covering. Fred more or less copied the Duesenberg, more or less copied the Mercedes, but he used a larger diameter tube, which gave us more space between the sheath and the inner tube. And anyway, that became the hallmark of the supercharged Duesenbergs. So when Augie did the adapted the supercharger to the Auburn, he worked with the chassis department and the layout, and they copied the Duesenberg type of outside exhaust pipes on the Auburn. And then sometime during the summer of 1933, Ames came up with the idea that inasmuch as the 35 Auburn was already on the market, and this was months ahead of the auto show, that we should have something spectacular for the auto show. And in 1933, Auburn had built a speedster that was designed by Al Leamy, and Ames asked me if I thought we could use one of those old bodies. They had about 100 of them left over at Union City Body Company, and cobble up a speedster for the auto show. And if we could, he thought that we ought to build about 4 of them just to show at the auto show. And so we brought one of these bodies up from Union City, and it wouldn't fit the frame of the 35 Auburn. There'd been a change in the frame, so we had to alter that. And the cowling was a little more narrow on the 33, so we had to have a special hood made. But we decided we could use the center part of the body from the 33 speedster, and we set the new 35 Auburn radiator and grill up in proper position, which established the hood problem. And from there on, it was just a matter of working in hot clay to design the fenders. And we cut the body off about a foot aft of the cockpit, so the whole new end, the back end of the car was new. About 3 years prior to this, I had designed a couple of speedsters, boat tail speedsters for Duesenbergs. And we decided to use the design detail off of the Duesenberg. So the Auburn 35 speedster was a copy, really, of the earlier Duesenbergs. But I think we were lucky, because the Auburn turned out to have much better proportions than the Duesenberg. And it became a very pretty automobile and was quite a sensation at the auto shows. It turned out. Let's wait a minute till I get my breath. I've been asked to reminisce about the association I had with Fred Duesenberg. My first meeting with him was when I was started working for the company and as their body designer. And I had a drawing table in one end of the engineering department, and I knew who Fred Duesenberg was, but he came in and introduced himself. He says, "I'm Mr. Duesenberg." I said, "I'm Fred Duesenberg," as though I wouldn't know who he was. But he didn't have an office, and he didn't have a secretary. He merely had a desk in one end of the engineering department. And everything at Duesenberg was small. There were probably Walter Trummel was the chief draftsman, and had about 4 chassis draftsmen, and we had an old-fashioned blueprint machine in there, and some very antiquated filing system, and a blueprint boy by the name of Oscar Hadley. Anyway, Fred was not at his desk. He was out in the plant a good deal of the time. And we got along fine, and he never indicated that he was an expert on body design. And of course, I never indicated that I was an expert on engines. So, but he was a real genius, and his brother, August Duesenberg, was not connected with the company at all at that time. Later on, after Fred died, why Augie worked for the company. But during the development of the Model J Duesenberg, Augie was not involved in it at all. He had a shop across the street where he built race cars. And
this is in Indianapolis?
Indianapolis, yeah, out on West Washington Street. The company didn't build any bodies, so all the bodies were built by custom body firms. However, we did have a paint shop and a trim shop, and this could be used to repaint and retrim some custom bodies, or it could be, sometimes bodies would come in from the bodybuilders in the white and would be put on the chassis and finished there at the plant. Anyway, Fred loved to work on the drafting board. He had arthritis in his hands, and he was in pain all the time when he was working on the board. But after I'd been there about a year, he invited me to move out to his home. And I rented the third floor of his home and became more or less a member of the family. And his son, Denny Duesenberg, at that time was in high school. And it was a funny setup at the Duesenberg Company. Harold Ames was sales manager and president of the company, and he had a Duesenberg Company car that he used all the time. Pearl Watson was the factory manager, and they supplied him with a company car. And the plant superintendent was a fellow named Camel, and they supplied him with a car, but they never supplied Fred Duesenberg with an automobile. And Fred had an old Model A Duesenberg that he used as his personal car, which is interesting in that not too long ago, someone was telling about a certain car, Model J Duesenberg, and they said that was Fred Duesenberg's car. And I said, well, that's impossible. He never had a Model J Duesenberg. Anyway, Fred was a genius as an engineer and incredibly smart on metallurgy. And he would, his experience with race cars had taught him how to design things for extreme lightness and yet be strong enough to stand up for a 500-mile race. And I remember one instance where Mr. Ray Day from the Ray Day Piston Company was there, and he was telling me that when the aluminum connecting rods were designed, that their engineers had run stress analysis on them And in theory, they would break, but they didn't break. And Fred worked out a design and had them cast these connecting rods in lead. And then he had some files, and he would just sit there at his desk and file this connecting rod until it looked right. And then when it looked right to him, he turned it over to Walter Trumbull and said, "Well, this is it, draw it up," and that was the way it was done. But he just had a sixth sense of design. And of course, the Model J Duesenberg, which was really a masterpiece of design, was 460 cubic inches, and I think it was a 4 1/4 stroke, something like that, and yet it would wind up to better than 5,000 RPM and still hang together. So I can't, I'm not a chassis engineer, and I can't really elaborate on his design work, but he was a straightforward man. I remember when the 12-cylinder Auburn engine came out, that was designed by Lycoming. A fellow by the name of Bill Baster was the chief engineer. And when those first engines came out, they didn't produce the horsepower that was expected of them. So Mr. Cort sent a engine down to Fred Duesenberg and asked him to see if he could get some more horsepower out of it. And Fred worked on it for a couple of weeks. And I was living at his home at that time. And he had a drafting room in his home. And he worked mainly in the manifold section of the engine. And in 2 or 3 weeks' time, he had this engine producing a lot more horsepower. And it was through the redesign of the intake manifold, mainly. And then Fred took a couple of weeks off and went fishing. But he was performance-minded. He could, I remember one time they had an engine, a race car engine, and it had 8 carburetors on it. And they had it on a block, on a dynamometer arrangement. It was a pretty crude dynamometer, but it was the best they had. But anyway, they were working at night, and he had all the lights turned out, and he was tuning each carburetor by the color of the flame coming out of the exhaust port. But this was typical of his direct approach to doing things. And it's too bad that he was killed when he was. I mean, he died as a result of an accident when he was, I believe, 55 years old. And
an automobile accident.
He had been in the East and was bringing a car home from the New York office. He stopped in Philadelphia and spent the night with a friend of his by the name of shut it off a second. Spent the night at the home of John Warren Watson, who built the Watson Stabilators. And some years after Fred's death, I was at his home, and John told me that before Fred left that morning, the next morning, in this Murphy car, he went out with him, and he said the tires had a lot of miles on them. And he told Fred, he said, "You shouldn't drive that car with those slick tires." but Fred did anyway, and that may have been one of the reasons that later on Fred lost control of the car in the mountains and had an accident which put him in the hospital, and then he died a couple of weeks later from pneumonia. You don't want that in about that. Fred was very active in the Society of Automotive Engineers, and he was well liked and well respected by everybody in the engineering society. I remember one remark he made one day about not getting credit for something that he had done, and he said, well, people that worry about getting credit never get anything done. But when the Stutz company was doing a new engine, a four-valve straight eight, I believe it was. It was right when the last engine that Stutz did. And they wanted to, in many respects, it was somewhat like a Duesenberg engine. And Fred just bundled up a bunch of drawings, everything covering the Duesenberg engine, and sent it over to Stutz for them to use. And but that was the type of person he was.
At this point, Mr. Bjerg, could you could you give us a an overview of the Cord Duesenberg Auburn corporate setup in terms of Mr. Cord's participation and beyond?
Well, of course, I was working for Stutz at the time that that Cord started the Duesenberg thing. And so I don't really know too much about that, but there's been a lot of things written about the Duesenberg company that are looked upon as being historically accurate, and they're not accurate at all. I was reading something the other night about in a book put out by Albert many years ago on Duesenberg, and he said that about one out of every five Duesenbergs was actually custom built for a customer. And that is not accurate at all. I think it was more like one out of 100 at the most, because during the 4.5 years that I worked there as their chief body designer, there was only one occasion when we did a one-off body for a customer. And I think after I left there that Herb Newport did one or two maybe, but to my knowledge, practically all of the Duesenberg cars were bought off the showroom floors or were duplicates of bodies that were already built, and they would just specify paint and trim. Which was really the heart of the custom body business, not only with Duesenberg, but also with Packard, Pierce Arrow, and Lincoln. They would buy. In fact, they would put out a custom body catalog and buy maybe 100 bodies of a kind, and then the body company would build them and put them in storage, and whenever a car was sold, they would send a chassis out to the body company and pull a body out of storage and finish it, paint it, and trim it. And that was the heart of the custom body business. But the Torpedo Phaeton body that we did for Mark Lawrence was the only car during the 4.5 years that I was there that was actually done specifically for a customer, And then we built six more of them after that. So, and another thing is that I noticed in that book, it mentioned about Phil Durham being there as the head of the body engineering department. There was no body engineering department. We had no reason for it. We didn't build any bodies. And Phil Durham came there about a year after I did, and he was our body engineer, but there was no department. He had no one working for him, and his job was to travel to the body companies and sort of follow up and check their engineering and make sure that the car was done right. But